CliffCentral.com. We're joined by Ivor Chipkin this morning. Now, let me introduce Ivor to you. This is all in the Burning Platform today, brought to you by Nando's. Obviously, we have uncensored conversations about all the things that are going on in the world around us, and we hear different points of view, hopefully from a wide range of people who have interesting experience to bring to bear, and today should be no different. So, Ivor Chipkin, Ivor, it's very nice to see you. Thanks for making some time for us.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. Ivor is the founder of the Public Affairs Research Institute at Wits University, today runs South Africa's first global think tank on government. And my God, do we need one of those? We need more than one of those. He was one of the key authors of Betrayal of the Promise. That's a report on state capture. It was a seminal 2017 expose on corruption and the anti-constitutional rule of the Zuma administration. He also has a PhD from the École Normale Supérieure, which is in France. He's an Oppenheimer Fellow at Oxford. He's the author of two books and also is one of the leading scholars on government and what government policy should be, what it absolutely should not be. He hosts a podcast with Toby Shapshak, who's been a recurring guest on the show too, called Filling the Gap with two P's. Go and look that up, Filling the Gap. So, Ivor, very nice to see you. That's a hell of a CV. I'm almost frightened about where we should start this morning because I'm sure you have plenty to say about so many things. We're also joined by our return champion, Canthan Pillay. How are you, Canthan?
I'm excellent as always, guys.
Yeah, I'm not going to go through your CV because I don't want to have you and Ivor arguing about who's more smart and worldly and knowledgeable.
Who's more famous? That's
the... So David Bowie was right. Okay, gentlemen, there's lots of stuff to talk about today. Where shall we begin? Let's just talk about the president last night. Did both of you or either of you see him?
No, I actually was busy doing my laundry or something like that.
Very dismissive.
I watched up until we needed to put the baby to sleep. So
I heard
a good chunk of it, just enough to hear that that we can travel overseas again, or looks like. I think that's what he said.
There were one or two interesting things in there, and some people, you know, immediately jumped to the idea that there's a conspiracy involved when the government want an app to be downloaded onto your phone. Now, who can blame them? We have the defunct but still present NIA in this country, and we know what skullduggery they've been involved in terms of phone tapping and all the rest of it, but mostly in the political arena. Would you download the government's app so they can track you, in inverted commas, for COVID, Canthan? I know you don't particularly like being tracked by anyone.
I think the issue really is how much information is actually being tracked and to what extent it's going to be end up being used. The useful thing in terms of the way in which Apple, for example, currently manages your privacy stuff, mm-hmm. is that they do put in place very specific rules around how government is able, or anyone who actually owns the app, is able to make use of your location tracking and so forth. So at that level, I don't have any objections to actually using a government app. I just couldn't be bothered to do so because it's not as though they're likely to do anything useful with the information that they get. Consider the volumes of paper that have accumulated over the course of this lockdown. I mean, every time I go, for example, into small businesses, you know, they take down my number and my temperature and they write it painstakingly on pieces of paper. And where is that ever getting processed? So, you know, screw them. I have no interest whatsoever in adding to the bureaucracy. I'm really interested in who actually was responsible for designing the app, how much they got paid for it, what is their business model, because there will be corruption behind this, guys. Trust me.
So, Ivor, this is really something that you are often involved in, is the observation of government, government policy, and the things that government has been doing incorrectly. I mean, you could take your pick, but the president did refer last night, it might have been during the time you were putting the baby to bed, but the government did the president did refer to all the corruption that's been going on around PPE and tender scandals during this COVID pandemic. But really, this was one of the last chances, and he's got very few chances left, this president, to take control in a meaningful way. Perhaps it's a fantasy of mine. But I had this idea that he might have gone on TV last night and said, all right, guys, we do have to ease out of this lockdown for various reasons. International travel will open up, which he said is conditional upon which country you want to go to or which country wants to come in here. But that he would have said, I've decided we're taking a hardline approach to this this corruption stuff. I'm going to reshuffle my cabinet accordingly. There are some people that we need to move out. And have taken a stand against the bad guys, because he would have had enormous public support. And although he might have put himself in a dangerous or controversial position within the ANC, he still has some ammo. He just doesn't seem to want to use it. Or am I being completely naive, Ivor?
Look, I think there's so much to talk about here. I mean, I think this question is a recurring question, and I wonder, Gareth, if we're not all being a little bit naive in regard in expecting him to step up in the way in which you in the way in which you're calling him to step up.
Yeah,
I'm sure there are elements of Ramaphosa's personality and his politics and his political relationship with the ANC. I mean, I remember Gareth Van Onselen wrote a very, I thought, an excellent piece about Ramaphosa a while back, saying, you know, this is the man that had been. You know, he'd been deputy president during the Zuma period. Mm-hmm. Yes, he may have been playing a long waiting game, but he'd been part of that process. He's deeply implicated in ANC politics. To expect much of him is naive. So I think there's some of that. But I also think the question plays into it's a fantasy which we all have, a desire which we all really want, and that is this idea that someone in South Africa is in control. That there's a big man, a president, an office, the presidency, the national treasury, that somehow there's someone or some institution that's got a kind of overall control in South Africa, and we just want them finally to kind of step forward, man up, take responsibility. I think that fantasy is a fantasy. Yeah. I think the problem with South Africa over the last 20 years, and this is drawing on the apartheid period, is that the country is highly, highly fragmented. And I don't just mean socially in terms of identity politics and conflict, etc. I mean institutionally. Where are the institutions that have that kind of footprint nationally, that have an ability to exercise control over regional elites, former Bantustan elites, provincial administrations, dynamics in local government? I don't think there is anybody. And I think we're seeing Ramaphosa constrained in the NPA, for example. So when we say, well, let's move forward on those criminal cases against all those baddies, all those corrupt people, and the NPA is so slow, I think we have to take seriously the counterpoint that actually the NPA has been hollowed out. That even if the NPA wants to go for these people, the institution is so broken that it can't. It's the same with the police, the hawks, for example. It's the same with so many of our administrations. When they want to move forward, even if there's real, genuine political will, and I think in the case of Ramaphosa, sometimes there is that will, I think there just isn't the institutional backing to move forward. And that's why, so I think the app question is interesting, but I think what I found really interesting, and some of the work that I've been doing more recently, is around the new sort of economic way forward. This new proposal coming out of NEDLAC, a new social compact between various partners, business, labor, on an economic moving forward. You know, I've been reviewing, I've been doing some work on these economic plans, and I've been reviewing them not for what they say about economic policy. It's not my field. I'm not an economist. I've been reviewing them for what they say about government. What assumptions do they make about who's going to implement these plans? And when you look at those plans from that point of view, the ANC's plan, Business for South Africa's plan, the Treasury's plan, there are various plans in circulation. Institute for Economic Justice has put some stuff out, the 100 Economists. All of those plans are absurdly, absurdly naive. Either they say nothing about the institutions of government. So there's a kind of a willful imagining that you put money through institutions and somehow they're going to perform.
Yeah.
Or they make crazy assumptions about those.
You know, you've just made such a good point about the fragmented nature of our politics and the fragmented nature of all of these best laid plans. What I mean, in the end, it's a pessimistic view, but it's very realistic in that we're only ever going to make incremental change because no one's got the balls or the constituency or the mandate to make the massive changes that we need. And anyone who does will find themselves at odds with a large constituency of people who find that unacceptable. So are we then stuck in a kind of paralyzed state forever, where we just hope that the world economy pulls us up, or where we hope that someone good takes over in certain of the institutions that need strengthening and decides to bring unto themselves power for good or for bad? How else do we move forward? Because it seems to me that they're just this kind of this apathy that we're stuck in is as a direct result of that fragmentation.
Gareth, let me posit a scenario out here. And if we're going to be doing blue sky thinking, I think, you know, let's just take this view. Really, what needs to happen is to consider the nature of the way in which the ANC works. And that is, in order for them to continue the party having control of power, they need to have control of the presidency of the party, which then gives them the ability to recall a president. Now, the current scenario we have is that Ramaphosa is president of the party. And in order for him to be recalled, effectively the NEC then has to recall him and then pass the instruction to Parliament that he's going to be removed. However, because that he's currently president of the party, it's really difficult for the NEC to then convey that message through to the rest of the MPs in order to force him to be removed from office. Yeah. So consider this scenario. Ramaphosa actually surprises all of us and decides he's willing to be a one-term president. And that's a very crucial part of this, okay, that he says, well, I'm actually going to use this opportunity to actually fix stuff. All he has to do is firstly say that he's not going to attend any further meetings of the National Executive Committee. Okay, so in other words, he just basically pushes them aside. Then he reshuffles his cabinet, and then he basically has a window of opportunity between now and the next consultative conference to actually drive a truck through everything that is responsible for screwing up the economy and screwing up the country. But it actually requires that Ramaphosa have the balls to do so, and it actually requires that he be willing to say, I'm going to do this in the interests of the country, and I'm going to be a one-term president. Because by the time the next elective conference for the ANC comes up, I will be voted out of office, but that's fine. I can't actually afford to do that. Now, is that likely to happen? Oh, I don't think so. Ramaphosa up until now has really consistently been as limp-wristed as you can possibly expect in this scenario. But is he likely to surprise us? Well, I don't know. There's been some interesting rumblings that I've been hearing along the grapevine about meetings that have been taking place with former ANC leaders and a rapprochement between Team Ramaphosa and Team Mbeki, among other things. And, all unconfirmed rumors, of course, because my entire thing around trusting any information that comes from within the ranks of any space is anyone who leaks information wants to set a particular agenda.
Sure.
So, but that's the scenario. And ultimately what this hinges on. So what I'm saying is we have the ability, if Ramaphosa steps up to the plate, he can actually do something.
I mean, he would really catch a lot of people off guard. And because there is an ANC way of doing things, it would be so unexpected in some quarters that these people would be caught with their pants down.
Absolutely correct, yes.
I know, but Ivor's right. It is a fantasy.
Yeah, I think we're a little bit too preoccupied with the ANC and its internal dynamics. I think we've been waiting. I mean, I certainly have been. There was the Mbeki, we all kind of looked to Zuma to rescue us from. I mean, remember that letter by Bolela Mankhu at the height of the AIDS debacle, writing to Mandela, Mandela, please save us.
Yeah.
We keep looking to individuals to kind of rescue us. So we're preoccupied with individuals, we're preoccupied with the ANC. I think if we go that route, I mean, I think there is some possibility. I'm just wondering what those initiatives would be and how sustainable they would be, even if it was a kind of a bold maneuver. It seems to me that we need to focus much more on institutions of government, institutions of the state for anything to happen. And that's where the real weakness in the current situation is. Many of these institutions have been hollowed out when they've been built, or they were never really properly constituted from the apartheid period. I mean, we're still living with the legacy of the bantu stans.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to look at the Eastern Cape, for example, I mean, there's an old joke that we were colonized by the bantu stans in 1994. Well, you know, it's not so funny to look at the Eastern Cape today and to say, well, essentially what it's reverted to the Siskai. The Eastern Cape is essentially the old Siskai bantu stan. It's essentially run from Bishu. It's run by old Siskai officials. So these sorts of institutional histories and institutional dynamics, I think, matter as much, perhaps even more, than the particular dynamics in the ANC. And that brings me, Gareth, can I make the further point?
Yeah, of course.
I'm talking about the kind of stasis we're in.
Yeah.
So this is where I suppose I'm very peculiar. I'm preoccupied with stuff which everyone else thinks is incredibly boring. But when you look at it historically, maybe it's not so boring.
You know, you mean the institutions?
Around institutions.
Yeah.
So look at something extraordinary that happens in the 2000s. Real developments take place. One can call it the Mbeki period, but I don't think these are essentially Mbeki initiatives. 1994 comes, you inherit a state that is really in a virtually in a state of collapse. Mm-hmm. Department of Inland Revenue, for example, the responsible for tax collection, can't collect taxes. Never mind the economic crisis, the basic institutions of the state are virtually in collapse. You've got this extraordinary process of integration of the bantu stans, largely into provinces. Government is really, really, really in a mess. And yet, look at the achievements, extraordinary achievements that are made in that period. We established the Southern Revenue Services, unbelievably effective tax collection agency. We built the National Treasury in 2000. We set it up. National Treasury pulls off something quite remarkable. It manages to, it goes under the very boring name of fiscal consolidation, but essentially what it does, it manages to bring all the bits and pieces of money sprinkled around the state under central control of the National Treasury. An extraordinary achievement. So there are these quite remarkable achievements in the late 1990s and 2000 around institution building in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me it's the only real way forward that South Africa can build a modern state.
I don't disagree with you at all. The real work is always kind of boring. It does involve meetings and long hours and paperwork and rooms full of people who are dedicated to doing things which can be achieved on a massive scale, and usually those things aren't very interesting, and they're not symbolic or theatrical. They're meaningful, and they have long-term consequences.
Exactly.
I do agree with you, but the problem is in this country, I don't even know if we have the political will to do those things, and that's why when someone comes along who fulfills the mandate of her office, like Thuli Madonsela did, we all regard her as a hero forevermore after she leaves office. It seems to me that a lot of career politicians, and this is why I'm glad you're on the show this morning, a lot of career politicians are really only in it for themselves. You did this really interesting report a long time ago now, but it was the promise report on state capture. This is very comprehensive. It's a look at what goes on inside the capture of the state and what motivates people. When you get to the bottom of it, Ivor, what kind of people are our political class in this country, and why are they so desperately greedy? Why are they so uninterested in the very electorate that puts them into the positions that they occupy via the ANC, which is obviously an obstacle within itself? And what is it that motivates these people besides just aberrant greed?
Yeah, I think it's a superb question.
We need to deal with the disease, not the symptoms. And the symptoms are corruption, but the disease is something else.
So let me throw something back at you. Joel Netshitenze, who, you know, also the man that gave us cadre deployments. Joel Netshitenze is he's an outstanding intellectual. And he wrote a piece for the ANC Journal Umrabulo many, many years ago. And he made a point which I think is a key point about understanding what you call in greed. He said, you know, South Africa, you have to understand what constitutes a middle-class standard of living in South Africa is actually not a middle-class standard of living almost anywhere else in the world. It's artificially high. It was set by kind of apartheid standards, two cars, a house, a swimming pool, a holiday twice a year. These are not middle class standards. These are the standards of in most countries around the world. This is how the super rich live. And yet in South Africa, the sense was that is how the middle class lives. So there was this huge politics of kind of creating a middle class with an expectation that's what the norm should be. But of course, to achieve those standards of wealth in South Africa were completely unrealistic. So his argument went that what it did was it created huge indebtedness amongst the black middle class. People got into enormous financial stress. And it made many politicians who also were pursuing this middle class standard of living, it made them vulnerable to capture by corrupt networks. So I think that argument is very interesting for this reason. What it asks us to think about is greed in relation to what people regard as the kind of normal things to have, the normal standard of living.
But aren't we? It sounds a little bit like we're making excuses for people instead of judging them by their choices.
Well, take the other dynamic. One of the big phenomena of post-apartheid South Africa is the growth of Pentecostal churches. Mm-hmm. It's one of the most surprising developments.
Sure.
Many people are in Pentecostal churches today, and associated with Pentecostal churches is the prosperity gospel.
Yes.
So what is the prosperity gospel about? It's about the idea that your relationship to God is manifest through prosperity, your ability to access things and display and consume, et cetera, et cetera. Again, it's a huge cultural pressure to perform having certain kinds of goods and a certain kinds of lifestyle. I hear you say that these are excuses. These are just bad people, greedy, et cetera.
They're not bad people, bad choices. I don't want to say bad people.
But are they bad choices within a larger culture of bad choices?
Well, if you get yourself into debt, that's really not the government or middle class ideas or Joel Netshitenze or white supremacy's fault. That's really if you get yourself into debt, there's no one else who can be blamed for that but you.
No, but it's why you pursue and why you seek out certain kinds of things. Why? Take cars, for example. What is the thing in South Africa about cars?
Yeah.
Why do we pursue to have these enormous cars? I mean.
I think that, you mentioned what's
the
fascinating.
PBE
what's
corruption?
What's
what that guy? He got that PBE contract, and what did he do? He went and bought
like four or five cars. Yeah.
Yeah, this is just astonishing.
So, Ivor,
you
just hit on something, though, that I had not considered up to now. And I think it's really – this is, again, why I love having people like you on with really interesting and nuanced points of view. I didn't think about this Pentecostal prosperity idea because I do think that's part of it. I've been trying to figure out why people like Malusi Gigaba will have bags of cash from the Guptas and essentially be willing to prostrate himself in front of money and go and buy fancy suits in order to feel like he's worthy. These are things that I've been thinking about for a long time, because if we can identify what that need is, what that howling, desperate, personal hole in some of these politicians is, if we can identify that, we might be able to fill that gap with something. And I don't think it's material. I think it's got something to do with respect, and I think it's got something to do with self-worth and esteem and all of that stuff. But if we can figure that out, we might be able to get the best out of some people who actually have some talents in public administration. And certainly some of them, their motivation might be good. Let's assume that they're not all just in it to be criminal. Canton, don't you like that point that Ivor made about that prosperity narrative?
No, I don't. And the reason why I don't is because it actually is giving a free pass to these guys. My view, very, very simply, go back to the beginning when we carved out this new South Africa and divided the country into 9 provinces. The reason why we did that was to effectively create jobs for the ANC. We did not need 9 provinces. We had actually succeeded absolutely fine with 4 provinces. And we could really go back now to running the country with 4 provinces. Well, yeah, effectively, we just need Gauteng, KZN, the Western Cape, and then lump all the other provinces together. And we can, you know, call them the welfare province. You know, because effectively, they are a net drain on the economy. Well, the 3 provinces, as I mentioned, actually are net contributors to the economy.
What did you say?
I was saying Canton's forgetting that the ANC didn't want provinces. It wanted a central government, which essentially there was a central state, and then powerful municipalities. It didn't want this large middle belly of provinces. This was a concession. This was pushed for by Inkatha and the National Party, who wanted a federal dispensation. So the ANC, if you like, reconciled themselves ultimately to having these large provinces. It's done very well out of them, by the way.
Yeah, no, they've certainly seen the opportunity and grabbed it with both hands.
They've certainly seized the opportunity, but the design of the provincial government system wasn't. This wasn't an ANC baby. This was one of the rather unfortunate children of our negotiated settlement. Which is not.
Look, we could go back and forth around who wanted what in terms of what went down at Kodesa. But let's just cut to the chase around this, that we have far too many people that are currently employed by government that actually do not serve any useful purpose whatsoever. And the first thing that one needs to do on the path to reducing the corruption that is so endemic is to actually remove those people from power. And that means downsizing government. But again, we are not ever going to have that situation coming to pass simply based on the fact that the people who are within those structures are the only people who can take the decision to actually get rid of those structures, and they are not likely to do that. So we have the scenario where really, effectively, if we are going to get to a situation where we're removing the ability of government to be able to do what it does, we have to remove their source of funding, and that ultimately means removing the tax base.
So, Ivor, what Canton's saying here is interesting. You're saying that we need to be able to concentrate on the factories that turn policy into practice. Where does that happen in government? Because ministers and directors general need to be competent, surely. And then somewhere in the bureaucracy under them, there need to be people who can make that policy into action and can create real change. And that is the boring work that you were talking about earlier. So we can't go around just firing people because we have a swollen government, and no one's going to disagree with Canton, I think. But we've got to identify who the people are that we absolutely need and who we can do without. And that's hard.
So, I mean, I agree with a lot of things that Canton said. I mean, take Eskom, for example. Eskom's financial crises is that from 2008, they just went on a hiring spree. I mean, there are just thousands and thousands of people at Eskom who have jobs which are, it's not clear what the value of those jobs are. And clearly there needs to be some serious restructuring and pruning. The problem is that in many cases, the new middle class, especially in the context of economic crisis in South Africa, largely are public servants. So going for pruning the public service is essentially declaring war on the black middle class. I don't think that that's a fight worth having. So I think there must be other ways in which one thinks about how to improve the performance of government. And that's why I think, Gareth, thank you for that question. I think it's around thinking much more around the sort of the policy and the structural issues around government, and that's where we potentially could have some movement. And that is getting public servants to be in a position where they can actually do their jobs properly. So one of the biggest problems we've had in South Africa since virtually the beginning is the politicization of the administration. The ANC took a deliberate position to deploy political officers into the administration that didn't respect the idea of the separation between the political and the administration. Rather, it sought to blur that boundary. And it did it for, well, you know, we can explain why they didn't trust the apartheid-era administration to implement new progressive policies. So they wanted maximum political control of the administration.
No. This is a blueprint directly that comes from the Chinese. They've learned from the Chinese, and they are implementing exactly the type of stuff that the Chinese do, except for the fact that, unlike the Chinese, they have allowed the unions control over dictating who gets paid what.
Look, I think the Chinese model is hugely influential. I think it slightly precedes it. I think it's part of the ANC DNA. It goes back to a long history of Marxism-Leninism and the relationship between party and state. But yes, the broader point is taken. Essentially, what's happened over since 1994 is that we've politicized our administrations. We've given the executive authority, the president, huge discretion over operational matters in state and enterprises, in all sorts of offices. Look at the testimony coming out of the Zonda Commission. We identified this in the betrayal report, by the way. It's just been confirmed in the Zonda Commission testimonies. Look at the Eskom stuff. You have the president trying to appoint the CEO of Transnet.
As Canton's pointed out before on the show, it even goes into corporate South Africa, where every board has got some ANC apparatchik on it, and where we've been forced to, by what is termed BEE, but has nothing to do with the empowerment of actual black people in the economy. It's got more to do with political control of the private economy. These people are now busy influencing even private corporations into behaving in accordance with the ANC. So that's been politicized too. I don't think anyone disagrees with you. It's a very poisonous process.
So the question is, this is a relationship that is well understood in the public administration space. And there's a long history of how to deal with it, starting in the late 19th century. The Chinese are pioneers in this regard, for example. The notion of a mandarin, for example, is a reference to the Chinese system of autonomous public servants.
Yeah.
So we know a little bit about this history, the reforms of the 19th century in Europe, for example, the reforms in the 20th century in America. South Africa had a highly politicized bureaucracy during the apartheid period, largely controlled by white men, a huge influence of the Bruderbond and the National Party. Instead of blocking or ending that history of politicization of the administration, what does the ANC do? It continues it through its cadre deployment process. We need to fundamentally interrupt that process. And the way to do it is by removing the discretion of ministers in the appointment of staff, which is currently what happens. Returning a whole lot of powers back to the Public Service Commission as an independent body to review appointments. We need to professionalize how public servants are appointed, how they are trained, how they are recruited into the public service. Most countries which have effective public services have a universal entrance exam. It's not because the entrance exams are so brilliant at attracting brilliant people, but what it does do is that it interrupts a political process for the appointment of public servants. We need to have public servants promoted on the basis of grade exams administered by an independent body. We need a national school of government through which public servants move. There are a whole lot of basic things which we could achieve, and we could achieve them quite quickly if we put the measures in place, which could begin to restructure the way in which the South African government works, and certainly remove huge areas of government from the discretion and the pathologies of internal ANC politics and internal ANC competition. And that's the kind of work which I'm interested in doing.
I think that it's terrific that there are people who are interested in doing that kind of work, because, as you've said before, it's not glamorous and it's not exciting and it's heavy lifting. But Ivor, I do want us to move, and Canton, to something that was much more of a current affairs story. We know about this jet that went off to Zimbabwe, this ridiculous meeting that was only ZANU-PF and Ace Magashule and Nomvula Mokonyane, Lindiwe Zulu, Nosiviwe Maphisa-Nqakula and Tony Yengeni, of all people. I mean, if those five arrived in my country, even if I was a tin pot dictatorship like Zimbabwe is, I'd think I'd definitely gone to hell. Anyway, they got off the plane, they met with ZANU, they didn't meet with anyone else, no other NGOs, no other parties, no other interest groups, just ZANU-PF, because they've realized that there's no one else worth talking to in Zimbabwe, because they've got a chokehold on any dissent. They then got back in the plane and came back. Turns out that it was an Air Force jet, that it was commissioned by, in this case, the Minister of Defense, and that effectively she's out of order by using government resources, defense force resources, for the ANC to do a little bit of hobnobbing with their friends in Zimbabwe. It's turned into a bit of a thing. The DA has laid a criminal complaint against the ANC delegation that went there. The public outcry has followed. I don't know how muted that public outcry has become by now, because people lose interest very quickly. But do we have anything to say about this? Because the party has admitted guilt, the ANC, on the matter, saying that they would reimburse the state. Of course, we'll see if that ever happens. And the president has requested an explanation, but he hasn't really said he's going to discipline the minister. What do you think's actually going on here?
Are we for a second believing that the president was not aware that this ANC delegation was heading off to Zimbabwe?
What is it?
Frankly, if that was the case, then the country is really in trouble. But if the president doesn't know what his own team is doing.
If he's denying it, if he says he didn't know, which is quite scary. He wouldn't be the first. I mean, we had other planes landing for weddings at Watercliff Air Force Base, which was the beginning of our uncovering of this huge state capture network, which Ivor played such a role in reporting on. What is it with our politicians and planes and illegal use of planes and airports? It seems to be a recurring theme in the ANC. What do you think, Ivor?
I wonder if it points to something which I think also goes to the heart of whether these new economic plans are achievable, and that is the fragmentation of the cabinet system. So when Ramaphosa says he didn't know about this trip, I actually think it's quite likely that he didn't know about it. And what it says is that the cabinet ministers are fundamentally, effectively, they're operating on their own. They're going off on their own missions, literally, actually, with their own claims. Mm-hmm. So what we saw under Zuma, for example, so under Mbeki, there was a pretty rigorous cabinet system of cabinet protocols, of how attendance at meetings, of developing an agenda for those meetings, of putting the relevant documents together so that the discussion was contained around key issues. All of that falls apart under Zuma. The cabinet protocol system basically collapses. A whole lot of decisions, those cabinet meetings are going on for hours and hours. Goodness knows what they're talking about. They have no real structure. They have no real purpose. And it's not clear that key decisions are being made in cabinet. As a matter of fact, there are a whole lot of extra parliamentary processes put in place where it sounds like key decisions are being made, including in the Saxon World House.
Yes.
So I don't know if the cabinet system has been reconstructed. So what we're seeing with this little jaunt up to Zimbabwe now, it might well be evidence that the cabinet system has not been re-established with the kind of coherence that it used to have, and that essentially cabinet ministers are able to operate, well,
with largely autonomy,
independently on each other. I mean, that's what it says to me, that all Ramaphosa's, you know, talk of putting in place good governance, that he hasn't put in place some of the key instruments he needs in order to effectively govern South
Africa. Well, it starts from
govern his ministers.
Yeah, it starts from the top down. If you can't even keep the weekly cabinet meeting in order, how the hell are you going to run anything else?
I mean, I think that's the key question. And I don't know. How things have changed regarding how cabinet's being run.
So thank you. You've both pointed out that this is a bigger deal than many people would think it is. It's not just a trip to Zim for a few government officials. It's much, much more indication of something that could be a much bigger problem. Let's just turn for the last 15 minutes of the show, our attention internationally. There's a lot going on. Boris Johnson has created a new set of lockdown rules. Israel's gone back under hard lockdown. Australia, certain provinces anyway, Victoria, under very strict lockdown now. It seems to me that a lot of countries are panicking. There's a lot of knee-jerk reaction going on. But there's also enormous political pressure that comes with all of these lockdowns. And some of them, you could even say, are purely political and have nothing to do with the virus. Ivor, we haven't had you comment on international affairs before. You have the floor, and then Canton, I know, is burning to throw a few things in.
My international attention has been a little bit further to the east. I've been quite fascinated by what's been going on around this bizarre process of Israeli recognition of Kosovo in return for the agreement by the Serbian government to resituate its embassy to Jerusalem, and there's this remarkable scene of Vucic, the Serbian president, sitting in Donald Trump's office, looking like a naughty schoolboy, and then working through the document which the government has just signed, and looking rather surprised when he hears that he's moving his own embassy. So I think this quite extraordinary politics going on in the Middle East, the recognition of Israel by the UAE, other movements in Oman and elsewhere. So I think there's some quite astonishing stuff going on internationally in that regard. So that's where my attention's been focused.
Do you think that Donald Trump deserves a Nobel Prize for what he's done here?
Look, he's pulled off something. He's pulled off something, I think, historic. He's pulled off something which certainly the Israeli right have been trying to pull off for years and years that have never achieved, and that is essentially displacing the question of Palestine or the Palestinian issue largely off the Middle East agenda. So whether Trump deserves a peace prize for that, I would be...
Hold on. You both.
That's probably an unfair thing. I think it's more likely to say that he's decoupled it from the question of relationships in the Middle East. And that's a significant difference. I don't think that the Palestine issue is off the agenda, but the issue of actually decoupling that from relationships with the other Arab countries is something that is absolutely crucial. Because if you look right now in terms of the dynamics that are playing out between the Iranian bloc on the one hand and the Saudi bloc on the other hand, the need to actually be able to have lines drawn in the sand that are now going to determine the way in which you actually carve out a path to peace out there means that the entire question of Palestine has to be decoupled from it, which is not to say that there's anything unimportant about the issue around Palestine. But the fact of the matter is that not decoupling it up until now has meant that you've had a scenario where Israel has effectively needed to unilaterally deal with the entire Iranian question simply because all of Israel's other neighbors in the Arab world were considered to be enemies. And I think now this actually forces things more sharply into focus. I was very disturbed, for example, by that CIA report that came out earlier this week that was talking about the fact that they had picked up that the Iranians were considering assassinating the American ambassador to South Africa. Yes, and look, of course, you know, given the CIA's track record, one must be distrustful about the CIA making such information available. But again, if you look in terms of the historical circumstances in our country and use the example of the Rwandan leader who was executed in Santa, and no prosecutions have risen from that thus far. And I'm reasonably sure that our government is incapable of actually protecting any diplomats within our borders. So at that level, it is actually cause for concern that, you know, we might be pulled kicking and screaming into this conflict, given that this is fundamentally a conflict between the Americans and the Iranians. Yeah. And this goes back to the fact that Trump violated international law by assassinating Soleimani on Iraqi soil. So there are no good guys in this scenario. But what we need to look at is what's the best possible outcome that we can get, given that there are no good guys, and what is the path to avoiding most conflict rather than eliminating conflict. I think at that level, it is significant what's been happening out there. Going back to your earlier point, though, in terms of the lockdowns that are happening around the world, I think all of us are forgetting that there was only one reason for lockdowns. Only one reason, and that was to prevent overwhelming hospitals. Can we be clear about this? So do we have a scenario where hospitals are being overwhelmed?
Is it fair then to say that everything outside of that very clear delineated problem which we were trying to overcome about not overwhelming the medical system, anything outside of that is probably political?
It is absolutely political, but more to the point, it's actually absurd. I mean, the scenario that we have right now where we still have a curfew from, what is it, midnight to 4 a.m. I mean, what is that about? How does that in any way address the core question of not overwhelming the hospitals, which is the reason why we started this in the first place? We have governments around the world who are utterly clueless. And then on the other hand, you have Sweden's figures and you know, no matter what we may be saying, let's go back to the beginning. Everyone was saying that Sweden has got it wrong. And now, if you drill down into the figures, guess what? Sweden actually got it right.
Yeah.
Of course, at the same time, we must consider the fact that psychologically, the Swedes are far more equipped to be able to police themselves. But, you know, again, if we are going to use that argument in other parts of the world, you know, there's an element of racism that then comes in because we are saying, guess what? We can trust the Swedes to actually obey their own.
We can't trust anyone else, yeah.
Yes, but we can't trust anyone else.
What do you say, Ivor?
Look, I think, you know, I mean, the point that's been made is absolutely spot on. It was originally intended to prevent the crisis of the hospitals. And I have to say, in the South African context, that was largely achieved. We did prevent the overwhelming of the hospitals, other than in places like the Eastern Cape. Western Cape performed pretty well. Gauteng's performed pretty well. We put in place all that excess capacity. It is interesting. There's been an interview with the Swedish epidemiologist who led the campaign, saying he had a really rough time because he went against the global consensus.
Yeah.
And yet he's turned out largely to be correct. It looks like Sweden's avoided a second wave. There are two things that I think are going on. If one can abstract more broad, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You know, we've got two contradictory tendencies emerging currently in the COVID thing. We have COVID, this global epidemic, which more than anything has called for international cooperation, demonstrated how countries are not on their own, mm-hmm. how we, people of the world, are subject to same global phenomena. And yet you mentioned Boris Johnson and the British response and the European response. And at that very moment, under Trump, under Boris Johnson, etc., we have the reassertion of national politics. We have the reassertion of the centrality of nation states in global politics. So I was hoping, I'm an old-fashioned internationalist in this regard. I'm not a great fan of nation states. So there seems to be there's this contradictory tension which has come to the fore. And I was hoping that in the way in which the world responded, maybe it would give momentum back to more an internationally minded politics.
And we've all been disabused of that notion. It seems that countries have gone more within themselves and not looked outward. It's been really interesting to have you both on. Thank you so much, Kanthan Pillay, and thank you very much, Ivor Chipkin. There's so much more that we could discuss. I'm afraid we're out of time for this morning. But the Burning Platform, every Thursday, you can join us again next week at 7 o'clock for more. Any final word from either of you before we wrap this up? Anything we've left on the cutting room floor?
Yeah, I think at some level, I was nursing one of the hopes that I spoke about, that when you cut down to the chase, I probably, am an internationalist because I'd like the ability to be able to, for all of us as a species, to go and live wherever we want to and work and do whatever is actually going to fulfill our aspirations. But one thing has become very clear to me over the past period, that you can either have a welfare state or you can have open borders, but you can't have both.
That's an interesting point to leave us with. Ivor?
Oh, that's a provocation. you end on a provocation. I think Kanthan and I have disagreed on almost everything other than the decoupling of the Palestinian issue. I like your term. I've enjoyed it. Oh, I'd like to argue with them about that because I'm not sure I agree with you in that regard. It does raise complex questions about solidarity. I do think that, but I think to go back onto a very boring topic, to end on the boring topic, because that's my nature, I think the fundamental challenge in South Africa going forward is not economic policy. It's not so much what goes on in the ANC. I think it's that we journalists place forums like this, civil society. I think we need to be talking much more about public administration questions, about institutions, about how they work, around how to reform them. I think that is the big question in South Africa today, much more so than unemployment, much more so than economic growth. I think the key question in South Africa today is around the reform of government, around depoliticizing institutions. And I think that is the call which I think civil society needs to be made. And I think it's spaces like this need to be talking much more about. And that's how I would like to end.
Thank you both very much. And thank you for joining us this morning. We will see you tomorrow bright and early at 6 o'clock, cliffcentral.com.
Cliffcentral.com.